I want to preach this morning on ministry. That's why I wear the robe. I had a right to wear one. I'm not a real robey guy, so I don't tend to. But when I'm preaching on ministry, I wear one. I want to focus especially on preaching. What I understand preaching in our tradition is designed to accomplish, stirring listeners' hearts and enlisting their critical intellects. I hope, too, in the process, to share a little bit about myself and what drew me, lured me, into this ancient guild of the ordained. What is ministry? What, after all, do ministers do? People joke about us all the time. How we work only one day a week, how we come to dinner and eat all the chicken, how we preach morality, Elmer Gantry-like, while hustling various scams. But people also reach out to ministers daily, including this one, and when they do, it is usually no joke. In researching this sermon, I was strongly influenced by ESUC member Alice Blair Wesley's 2000-2001 Men's Lecture. Alice points out that the American Heritage Dictionary defines ministry as 1. A, the act of serving, ministration, and B, one that serves as a means instrumentally. Ministry then is service, and ministers are people who serve. But there's more. The second definition reads, the profession, duties, and services of a minister of religion. So a minister is one who serves, but serves in a religious way. There are different types of ministers. Parish ministers work in churches, but our work is complemented by ministers of religious education, community ministers, ministers of music, ministers who teach, and ministers who counsel. There are no clear boundaries between them. Indeed, each type of minister is asked to do all of these things. For most people, however, I suspect that parish ministry is the model we think of first. This is ironic, since many of the most famous ministries, including those of Isaiah, Jesus, and St. Paul, these were not parish ministers. Nevertheless, their ministries were and remain models, models that set a standard that we are called to emulate. From a factual standpoint, we don't know much about these three people. A careful reading of the Bible suggests that Isaiah, author of this morning's responsive reading on universal ministry, was a well-educated, upper-class inhabitant of the 8th century BCE Jerusalem. Jesus, born 700-some years later, came from an outland province, Galilee, spoke a provincial dialect, and, after a brief ministry, was put to death, executed by the state. Both Isaiah and Jesus spoke in poetry. The Apostle Paul's ministry was more that of a district executive, and he wrote in prose. He was a first century Jew and a Roman citizen. A profound experience transformed Paul virtually overnight from a persecutor of the early Christians into one of their foremost champions. He became a missionary, planting congregations across Asia Minor and Eastern Europe, and tending to them from afar via the mail. Others have followed down through the centuries, some whose names we know, Teresa of Avila, Martin Luther, Olympia Brown, right down to today in the persons of Leon Hopper, Joan Montagnus, and others who we here at East Shore have reached out to and who have reached back in service. There have been men and women of other traditions, pagan, Buddhists, or what have you, who have ministered and who are ministering as I speak. What are these people up to? There are many aspects to ministry. Few of us are good at all of them or even most of them. Service, after all, is a broad concept. We are asked to be counselors, teachers, cheerleaders, confidants, administrators, confessors, public spokespersons, ritual masters, caregivers, toastmasters, and all-around good souls. We are expected to be well-read and careful scholars and good researchers, fully versed in our own and other traditions. We are always on call. We are expected to be at dozens of social events, committee meetings, and a good number of civic proceedings. Members want their minister to be forthright without hurting anyone's feelings, erudite but down to earth, resolute but flexible, funny but not too funny, serious but never overly so, five-star quality without asking for much remuneration, as that would be unseemly, all agree, for a person of the cloth. When the church is discouraged or demoralized, it wants us to be shepherds, artists, and poets, bringing fresh waves of encouragement. When it needs organization and order, it requires that we become gifted administrators able to lead the way through chaos. When it needs edification, we are asked to have the gift of teaching. In addition, Unitarian Universalists usually want their ministers to be up-to-date, widely read in current events, scientific advances, and pop psychology, to be old salts who are also hip to what's happening now. Above all, members want us to be good preachers. But what does that mean exactly? Ask 10 UUs and you'll get 10 answers. Most, however, say they want to be entertained and enlightened, touched and affirmed, given hope and strengthened consciences. Now that shouldn't be too hard, should it? A few years ago, a frequent visitor to the church I was serving in Santa Fe, New Mexico, told me that she really liked one particular sermon, but that she couldn't stand the word sermon. It should be presentation or address or lecture. Didn't I think sermons, for Laura Lee, were just too religious? There was a time when I more or less agreed with Laura Lee, but after over 1,400 attempts at this, I've changed my mind. Unitarian Universalists expect to hear sermons that are thoughtful, didactic, and edifying, and if they are not, the minister may soon find her or himself in trouble. But ministers whose sermons are only thoughtful are apt to find themselves in trouble, too. In one of her newsletter columns, my colleague Christine Robinson, Minister Emerita now of the First Unitarian Church of Albuquerque, explains, "Sermons are different from talks, speeches, and lectures. The sacred aim of sermons is not to inform, to tease, to please, or to entertain, though all these things happen. It is to examine life in the light of value and spirit and speak the resulting truth in love so that lives are changed. And changing lives," concludes Christine, "is a tender, painful, glorious thing." Moreover, good sermons tell us something about the preacher, too. What does she care passionately about? What does he really love? In the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, preaching should be life forged through the fire of the mind. Life, concrete life, the preacher's life, life forged through the crucible of her or his heart as well. Emerson, like UUs ever since, dismissed most of the church's forms and rituals, but he never repudiated our mission. Though he moved away from traditional religious language, Emerson never moved away from that language's intention. If only preachers, and I'm quoting now, would acquaint men at first hand with deity, Emerson wrote, they would breathe life back into the church. Emerson liked good preaching, but complained he did not often enough hear it. The preacher's aim, he wrote, must be to convert life into truth, to show us that God is, not was, that he speaketh, not spake. In other words, make the space safe for the spirit, and through the use of poetry and music and ritual, somehow help it come to life, if only for a moment, in people's hearts and consciences and imaginations. It's a tall order, for sure, but it's what we want to hear from our preachers. It's what we long to hear. Unlike St. Paul, no single experience drew me into the ministry. It was more a series of ever deeper wonderings whether this was to be the craft which I would and wanted to devote my life energy. A series of experiences that continued long after I was actually ordained and continues to this day. Nevertheless, one critical experience happened in February 1977. It involved my late friend, former teacher, and close colleague, Paul Sayer. I was, in 1977, pursuing a career teaching religion in academia. I also wanted to be ordained, and in that effort, I'd done field work the year prior as an intern at the First Unitarian Church of San Francisco, and I had enjoyed that. Then the following year, this year I was in the midst of, 76, 77, and mostly for fun, I'd been working with Paul and a few other Berkeley types, trying to get a Universalist Center going there, a kind of non-churchy church as we envisioned it, with a strong activist focus. We were tantalized when we heard that the Veach program, a well-heeled UU-connected foundation on Long Island, would perhaps match donations to just such a project as ours. Then we heard about a wealthy Mendocino County lawyer who was looking for ways to spend his money, so we rented a storefront downtown and made plans for a special service. All our members and friends, about 25 to 30 people, attended. The potential benefactor and his beautiful wife arrived just in time. The service began with music, there were some announcements, a meditation, and soon the sermon. As it was February 22nd, Paul preached on George Washington, his revolutionary leadership, and his vision of democracy. Suddenly, about 4 minutes into the sermon, one of our members, a physician named Jerry, interrupted. Washington was a slave owner, he objected. He shouldn't be praised, period. Well, yes, countered Paul, he was a slave owner, certainly, but he also set in motion the chain of events that eventually, 86 years later, led to the slaves' emancipation. And moreover, all of us would look reactionary by the moral standards of a later era. Order was soon restored, and Paul was back into his sermon, as were all of us listening. Until Jerry chimed in again, with real vehemence this time, Washington was a slaver. He was a trafficker in human bondage, blinded by privilege and racism. He went on for several sentences. Yes, of course, explained Paul. He was all of these things, but this should not blind us to his manifold contributions to the cause of human freedom, his bravery, and his incredible vision. Again, it took longer this time. The preacher steered the service back to its aims and purposes, hopes of our little band of Universalists that we could become more established and substantial, until, yes, once again, we were sailing along, gaining momentum, finding our sense of equilibrium, community, and shared purpose. It was then that Jerry interrupted for the third and final time, spinning the service completely out of control. As this continued, Paul reached for and put his arms around an increasingly irrational Jerry. I realized I was witnessing a full-scale emotional breakdown as the parishioners slowly got up, one by one, then in twos and threes to leave. The attorney thanked a couple of folks, hopped into his BMW, and drove away. Wow. Here, in a matter of less than 10 minutes, all that we had worked for the preceding 6 to 8 months had been dashed, ruined, an utter fiasco. I, meanwhile, was completely blown away. It all seemed like a John Cage musical composition in which I heard the sound of silence for the first time, only in this case the tableau of Paul cradling Jerry in his arms caused me to understand parish ministry entirely anew. That it happened in a worship service, only added to its poignancy. For here was the essence of ministry, binding wounds, comforting the afflicted, offering love and consolation in the midst of everything we cannot control. Now I knew what Emerson must have meant, for God spaketh to me that day in the midst of debacle, and I could not get the echo out of my mind. Could this be the work to which I am called to devote my life energy? I remember asking myself as I walked home, could it be that ministry, not academia, is the career worthiest of my gifts and of my love? Consider for a moment our church covenant that we just read and that we read every week. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is our prayer, to dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve humanity in fellowship. Thus do we covenant. UU congregations at their best are loving people joined in such a covenant to find and live out together in so far as we can the ways of love. The essence of ministry, as I try to practice it, is to encourage, support, and nurture such communities. It's about love, but this is not a mindless process. God help us if we ever suppose that the ways of love are easy to identify or to live out in so complex a world such as ours. God help us if we are ever embarrassed to confess that finding them and living in accord with them requires that we think rationally about them together in our churches, hard and well, learning how to feel deeply and lovingly, and learning how to think, learning how to create and uphold welcoming and diverse communities rooted in love, trust, and freedom. Liberal ministry in a congregation like ours requires serving heart and mind always. For the congregation to thrive, however, it seems to me that its members need to be reminded again and again how central love is to the heart of what we are all about. Helping members experience, contemplate, and recognize what is truly lovable and lovely, I'm convinced, is a priori the first platform thing of good preaching. Why? As Alice Blair Wesley points out repeatedly in her lecture, this is not because love is more important than thinking, but it's because the experience of wholesome, worthy love, it's that experience that points us to those issues we need to think rightly about. It's easy to cite glaringly obvious examples. Consider, for instance, all the correct thinking about the hows of the project that it took to build and run the gas chambers in Hitler's Third Reich, or the system of apartheid in South Africa. The people who carried out those projects loved the wrong things. If they loved rightly, they would never have used their minds on such hows. Despite such atrocities, there are in all of us, Emerson believed, and I believe with him, deep springs of affection that readily flow and overflow. Ministry from the 7th century BCE to the 1830s to today identifies those worthy things to which good people naturally respond with love. Good preaching, something I aspire to more than I manage to practice, touches the heart and the imagination in such a way that it engenders the experience of love right then and there in the pew in the gathered congregation. This happened to me on Washington's birthday, 1977. The consistently effective preacher, then, is first a wooer, an enticer, speaking words that evoke love of what is worthy of love. Having elicited love, the best sermons will go on to provoke thought. In other words, first hold up that which is truly worthy of our love, but don't stop there. It's not enough to satisfy the heart's longing alone. Good preaching demands an additional step, acquainting listeners with the facts and stimulating them to think about what love asks of us. Poor understanding and irrational thinking thwarts even the best intentions. The best sermons address longings of the heart, yes, for sure. longings that lead directly to queries of the mind, which we can only consider properly when engaging one another rationally. Feeling love, even when we ought to be thinking, is sentimentality. Ever so much rational thought without love is certainly in churches not very fruitful, to put it mildly. Despite being abruptly cut off, Paul's message about General Washington's steadfast courage in the face of dubious odds, his dream of democracy, and his stick-to-itiveness all stayed with me, as did Paul's abiding concern for one of his congregants in crisis. Still, success in the ministry requires more than love alone, despite what John Lennon and Paul McCartney may have sung. It requires serious thinking about budgets, schedules, events, meetings, personnel matters, and much, much more. In other words, and in one ancient formula, we must be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. The final element of ministry, then, and of preaching, is vision, the ability to see clearly that which is worthy of our love, and to hold it up in such a way that others, whatever their theology, whatever their economic circumstances, can see it also. Perhaps there was a time 2,700 years ago and before when people were so atomized that no one had a vision large enough to inspire universal ministry as expressed, longed for by the prophet Isaiah. Centuries later, however, Isaiah's vision became the mission of American universalism, inspiring a here and now understanding that we are saved not by adherence to any doctrine, but through the quality of our everyday relationships with the people around us here and now. Churches really don't have all that much to do with it, except as places where we can continually remind ourselves and encourage one another regarding the value and sacredness of practicing how to love. In conclusion, the good preacher shares a little about themselves, reminds us of something that elicits feelings of love, helps us consider thoughtfully whether it's really worthy of our best energy, and then if it is, helps us find ways to bring that love to fruition through service. And all in 20 minutes. So may it be. Amen.